Chapter 1. The Snake with Broken Teeth. Helicopter hovering above Abbottabad at 1 a.m. is a rare event. Tweet by Sohaib Attar at Really Virtual, 12:58 a.m. PKT, May 2nd, 2011. Go away, helicopter, before I take out my giant swatter. At Really Virtual, 1:05 a.m. PKT. A huge window-shaking bang here in Abbottabad cantonment. I hope it's not the start of something nasty. At Really Virtual, 1:09 a.m. PKT. Sohaib Attar just wanted to get away from it all. His life in the Pakistani megacity of Lahore had been a dizzying burlesque of stifling heat, filthy air, unreliable power, and the ever-present danger of terrorist attacks. After a while, it had all become too much for the young software developer, so he had packed up his laptops and fled for the relative tranquility of the mountains north of Islamabad. Abbottabad must have seemed a promising place for a new start. The city lies cupped in a high-walled valley in the foothills of what becomes much farther to the north and east, the outer reaches of the Himalayas. At an elevation of 4,000 feet, roughly comparable to that of Salt Lake City, Utah, Abbottabad is known throughout the region for its agreeable hill station climate. The town's founder and namesake, the British Army Major James Abbott, waxed poetic about its sweet air and twittering birds. Its Anglican church, St. Luke's, also established by the British and built in a style that would have been familiar to soldiers homesick for the English countryside, still ministers to parishioners on Jinnah Road in the heart of the old town. Abbottabad was founded as a garrison city, and it remains so today. Since Pakistan's independence, it has been home to the prestigious Kakul Military Academy, the country's answer to West Point. The academy has trained much of the country's military leadership, including its former president, Pervez Musharraf. It is also a frequent port of call for top military brass from Pakistan's allies. General David Petraeus visited in February 2010, while serving as overall commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. Abbottabad's relative isolation and strong military presence conspire to create a sense of security that is sorely lacking in so many of Pakistan's other major cities. Unsurprisingly, therefore, Sohaib Attar was not alone in seeing Abbottabad as a place of refuge. Throughout the first decade of the 21st century, people had moved there from elsewhere in the country, fleeing earthquakes, flooding, and the violent war against Islamic extremists ongoing in places like Waziristan, a notoriously lawless region in the federally administered tribal areas, or FATA, 200 miles to the southwest, along Pakistan's frontier with Afghanistan. Abbottabad had also sheltered its fair share of less welcome transplants. Umar Patek, a key conspirator in the Bali nightclub bombing that killed more than 200 people in 2002, was arrested in Abbottabad in January 2011, together with Mohammed Tahir Shahzad, an al-Qaeda fixer who had arranged for Patek to travel to Waziristan alongside two French jihadists. It was not inconceivable, therefore, that other al-Qaeda operatives, perhaps even senior figures, could still be laying low somewhere in Abbottabad. About a mile and a half across town from where Sohaib Attar plied his screens and keyboards, in a relatively wealthy neighborhood, where a few large houses rose over gardens in which residents grew food, there stood a spacious compound of the type known locally as a mansion. It consisted of a three-story main house, a guest house, and a number of outbuildings, all surrounded by uneven high walls, in places rising to 12 or 18 feet, and crowned with a 2-foot tangle of barbed wire. The compound had no cable or telephone connections, although it did have a satellite dish. It lacked regular trash pickup. Evidently, its inhabitants preferred to burn their refuse on site. The balcony on the third floor of the big house, added following an earthquake that occurred in October 2005, was surrounded by an unbroken 7-foot screen wall. The plans for this edifice, listed the property's owner as Muhammad Arshad Naqab Khan. Khan was seldom seen, but when he did appear, he told neighbors that he was a wealthy money changer or gold merchant from the tribal regions, and that he needed high security to protect himself and his family from enemies he had made in that business. This seemed plausible enough. Besides, it was not uncommon for pious Pashtun families from the tribal lands to live in large, high-walled properties, to sequester their women and children indoors, and generally to keep to themselves. But Arshad Khan and his backstory were a fiction, an alias concocted to hide the true identity of the compound's owner. Ibrahim Saeed Ahmed was an ethnic Pakistani Pashtun whose family hailed from Shangla, a rugged, sparsely populated district in the mountains northwest of Abbottabad. Ahmed, however, was born and raised in Kuwait, and like many jihadis, went by his nisbe, or toponym, Al-Kuwaiti. Growing up in the tiny desert emirate, Al-Kuwaiti had become the boyhood boon companion of a fellow Pakistani, an ethnic Baluch named Khalid Sheikh Muhammad. KSM, as he later became known to investigators, had been a jihadi since he was 16 years old. Having fought the Soviets in the 1980s, he would go on to mastermind the 9/11 attacks in 2001 and carry out the beheading of the Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl the following year. Khalid Sheikh Muhammad also served as al-Kuwaiti's mentor in jihad. He got his friend a position as emir of an al-Qaeda guest house in the city of Karachi, in Pakistan's deep south, and introduced him to his sheikh, a Saudi militant chieftain named Osama bin Laden. Not long after this fateful meeting, al-Kuwaiti would begin a long service to bin Laden and his family as courier, domestic servant, and bodyguard. He kept this work, along with his other jihadi duties, a grave secret, even from those closest to him. In 2001, when he was around 35 years old, he married a 14-year-old girl from his home district and brought her to live with him in Karachi. He explained his frequent absences from the marital home by saying that he often traveled back to the Gulf on business. Throughout this time, Al-Kuwaiti remained close to his old friend Khalid Sheikh Muhammad. KSM's wife hosted a wedding feast for the new couple at her house. But it would be years before Al-Kuwaiti would tell his bride who this mysterious friend was, or admit that he, like KSM, was in reality a mujahid of Al-Qaeda. By then, there would be no going back. Following bin Laden's defeat at the cave complex of Tora Bora in late 2001, the Al-Qaeda leader fled over the mountains into hiding in Pakistan, shaving his long beard to evade recognition. Al-Kuwaiti was once again called upon to assist the sheikh in his time of need. In the summer of 2002, he set up a house for bin Laden in Swat, not far from his ancestral homeland in the north of Pakistan. Al-Kuwaiti moved his wife and children there too, and they were soon joined by his brother, whose name was Abrar, and Abrar's own growing family. The brothers, both olive-skinned and beardless, but with close-cropped mustaches in the traditional Pakistani style, did not look out of place in their country of origin. In exchange for their hospitality and protection, bin Laden paid the Kuwaiti brothers a salary of 9,000 rupees per month, around $100, which he supplemented from time to time with gifts and zakat, charity. The Swat house nestled in a pretty stretch of countryside by the banks of a river. To Osama bin Laden, this bucolic setting may have seemed a welcome respite from the relentless pace of frontline jihad. But any feeling of serenity would prove to be short-lived. In early 2003, Al-Kuwaiti's old friend Khalid Sheikh Muhammad brought his family to stay at the Swat house for 2 weeks. Just a month after he left, Al-Kuwaiti was watching the news with his wife when KSM's face unexpectedly flashed onto the screen. The 9/11 planner had been arrested in Rawalpindi, the twin city of the Pakistani capital, Islamabad. Al-Kuwaiti flew into a panic. KSM was a tough personality and an experienced operative, but there was no telling what secrets he might divulge. knowingly or otherwise under interrogation. Within a week, Al-Kuwaiti, bin Laden, and the other residents of the SWAT house had fled. Quickly, the brothers moved them to Haripur, a city to the east surrounded by squalid camps, sheltering some of the millions of refugees displaced by a quarter century of conflict in neighboring Afghanistan. Bin Laden's house in the suburbs, by contrast, was pretty and spacious, with three bedrooms, a lawn, and a roof terrace. But nobody ever visited him there. One neighbor noted that the brothers kept their gates shut, which was unusual for the area. When they needed to make phone calls, they would travel up to 90 miles away to use public call boxes. By late 2004, Al-Kuwaiti, operating under his assumed identity of Arshad Khan, had begun buying up tracts of land in Abbottabad cantonment for what would become bin Laden's mansion. In August of 2005, with construction on the main building complete, bin Laden moved in, together with two of his wives, his son Khalid, and a number of his daughters and grandchildren. Al-Kuwaiti lived with his wife and children in the guest house on site, while Abrar and his family occupied the ground floor of the main house. Eventually, the screened-off third floor, built after the October earthquake, became bin Laden's living quarters. Bin Laden always claimed to live in accordance with the ways of the Prophet, and few parallels between their two lives would have escaped him. So it is quite possible that he would have compared his flight from Afghanistan to Pakistan with Muhammad's Hijra, or migration from Mecca to Yathrib, the desert settlement that would eventually become Medina. In fact, he often called on his followers to make their own Hijra to Afghanistan. Since his arrival in Pakistan, bin Laden's movements from Swat to Haripur to Abbottabad had traced a path roughly due east, deeper and deeper into the country. 4 years after 9/11, he had made it roughly 200 miles from Tora Bora, about the same distance as the Prophet traveled from Mecca to Yathrib. Perhaps this was an auspicious sign. Everything about the Abbottabad mansion was geared toward privacy and self-sufficiency. The brothers hired a local farmer, a man called Shemrais, to plow an adjacent field for growing vegetables. There were animals at the site too, including chickens and a cow. Whatever food and provisions could not be grown, raised, or made on the premises, Al-Kuwaiti and Abrar would buy at the bazaar in town. Bin Laden was no stranger to Spartan living conditions. Indeed, for decades, he had deliberately sought out a life of privation. Like charismatic leaders before him, including the assassin leader Hassan Isabah, he cultivated this ascetic image as an important part of his appeal. Frugality came naturally to him. Indeed, it seemed to exhilarate him. When he returned to Afghanistan in 1996, he chose a grim, unkempt hideout in the mountains, in preference to several much cushier residences, including a former royal palace. Later, in the compound at Kandahar, his house was among the simplest on the base, with not even a carpet on the floor. In 2005, upon his arrival in Abbottabad, bin Laden's wardrobe consisted of no more than a black jacket, a couple of sweaters, and six shalwar kameez, the traditional Pashtun dress of baggy pants and a long shirt. In accordance with his fundamentalist reading of Islam, he had always kept the women of his household in strict purdha, separation from men outside their immediate family. In Abbottabad, that prohibition became a matter of security as well as religious obligation. Indeed, his rules were so absolute that from the age of 3, the bin Laden women were banned from watching television so that they would never see an unfamiliar male face. His children and grandchildren were sequestered inside the house almost 24 hours a day. The sheikh personally homeschooled them in the bin Laden brand of extreme religion and forbade them from playing with the children of Al-Kuwaiti and Abrar, who lived just feet away within the same compound. Such was their isolation that the sheikh did not even allow them to be vaccinated for polio along with the other children. The nearest the bin Laden children came to fun was their occasional competitions to see which of them could grow the biggest vegetables in the garden. Despite his well-known penchant for sports, hiking, and horseback riding, the sheikh's own health had taken a downturn in early adulthood from which he had never fully recovered. 48, when he began living in Abbottabad, he was practically blind in one eye, the result of a childhood injury he successfully concealed from the public for many years. In his 20s and 30s, during the jihad against Afghanistan's Soviet occupiers in the 1980s, he had suffered crippling bouts of pain and paralysis, which the former surgeon Ayman al-Zawahiri had treated with a glucose drip. Having inhaled Russian napalm in Afghanistan, he frequently had trouble with his larynx. In Abbottabad, he complained of pain in his heart and kidneys. But there was no question of visiting a doctor. Instead, when bin Laden felt ill, he would treat himself with al-tib al-nabawi, traditional medicine based on the hadith, sayings ascribed to the Prophet. Some believe, for example, that Muhammad recommended barley broth and honey to treat an upset stomach, senna for constipation, truffle water for eye ailments, and henna for aches and wounds. God has not made a disease without appointing a remedy for it, says one well-known hadith, with the exception of one disease, namely old age. By his early 50s, Osama bin Laden had become prematurely an old man. In videos made inside the compound, he appears hunched and frail, his face lined, his eyes tired. His beard, salt and pepper at the time of the 9/11 attacks, was rapidly turning white, although he was not above dyeing it jet black in video messages meant for public consumption. In his three-decade career of murder and mayhem, Osama bin Laden had gone by many names. His followers called him Azmare, the Sheikh, the Emir, the Director, Abu Abdullah. His code name at the U.S. Joint Special Operations Command was Crankshaft, reflecting his vital importance in driving the engine of Al-Qaeda. But one final nickname captured the diminished circumstances of his existence in Abbottabad. In the months leading up to bin Laden's death, observing his daily walks within the bounds of a compound he never seemed to leave, analysts with the Central Intelligence Agency had taken to calling him the Pacer. But Osama bin Laden was no ordinary shut-in, and he was by no means cut off from the world. Far from it. Until the day he died, the Sheikh remained in active control of the deadliest terror network in history. Communication with the outside was difficult, to be sure. Ever since the arrest of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, so soon after his visit to the house in Swat, bin Laden had cut off face-to-face contact with other senior jihadis, or indeed any al-Qaeda members other than his immediate protectors. No doubt this was a wise precaution for a man with a $25 million U.S. bounty on his head. Besides, house calls would be an impractical way of governing a network that bestrode much of the Islamic world. But remote means of communication were scarcely any more secure. Email was not to be trusted. Bin Laden knew from past experience that the Americans were capable of intercepting such messages, even with encryption. As he himself wrote in August of 2010, "Computer science is not our science, and we are not the ones who invented it. Encryption systems work with ordinary people, but not against those who created email and the Internet. Cellular communication, too, was risky, because it could give away a person's location and perhaps even call forth one of the hated unmanned spy planes that patrolled the skies over northern Pakistan. By this time, al-Kuwaiti had evidently acquired a cell phone, but whenever he needed to place a call, he would drive out from Abbottabad for 90 minutes or more before even placing the battery in his device. Instead, bin Laden, his deputy Ayman al-Zawahiri, and their senior jihadi associates relied upon a network of trusted couriers, among them al-Kuwaiti himself. These men would flit back and forth across Pakistan, carrying thumb drives full of jihadi correspondence. Bin Laden's principal point of contact was his factotum, a veteran militant whose nom de guerre was Atiyah Abd al-Rahman. but who was better known in jihadi circles as Mahmud. Mahmud hailed from the town of Misrata in northwestern Libya, along the coast from Tripoli and across the Gulf of Sidra from Benghazi. With his pale complexion, wispy facial hair, and boyish looks, Mahmud may not have struck many as the archetypal fundamentalist fighter. But whatever he lacked in appearance, he made up for in ability. He was a former senior member of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which formally merged with al-Qaeda in 2007. While bin Laden remained cloistered in Abbottabad, Mahmud presided over a small and frequently unruly private army of militants in Waziristan. The jihadi brothers, under Mahmud's control, hailed from all over the Islamic world and beyond that as far afield as Russia, Germany, and the Balkans. In many cases, their level of experience and discipline fell well short of Mahmud's standards. Instead of the unquestioning obedience he demanded, Mahmud encountered insubordination, sometimes verging on mutiny. The prolonged seclusion of the great jihadi figureheads complicated matters. Some newer members insisted that they would take orders only directly from bin Laden, Zawahiri, or their nominal superior, Taliban leader Mullah Omar. Certainly not from anyone as lowly as Mahmud. Others, disobeying security protocol, would hang out in the streets, gather together in large groups, or make calls on their cell phones, attracting attention and exposing themselves to American drone strikes or even worse, arrest by Pakistani forces. Still others would grandstand through the jihadi media, puffing up their credentials as commanders and sowing confusion. Some of these men, in Mahmud's opinion, just needed to grow up. Mahmud longed for the return of experienced senior operatives, good men who could help carry the burden. After 9/11, many of these old guard figures had sought secret refuge in Iran, only to find themselves arrested and imprisoned by Iranian intelligence. Some still languished in prison years later. Among them, a trio of seasoned commanders, Abu Muhammad al-Masri, had been the leader of al-Qaeda's famous training camps and a principal architect of the 1998 bombings of U.S. embassies in East Africa. His daughter is married to bin Laden's son Hamza. Abu Khair al-Masri was once al-Qaeda's political chief, and he sheltered bin Laden at his Kabul home in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. Finally, Saif al-Adal had been al-Qaeda's stern and steadfast head of security, responsible more than anyone for keeping bin Laden safe and for developing networks in Somalia, Yemen, and elsewhere. Bin Laden agreed with Mahmud that the release of these men would be a great benefit to jihad and to the Mujahideen. Mahmud recommended that to be safe, those returning from Iran go through a reintegration program. They should spend 6 months or even a year getting familiar again with how things work, he wrote. During that time, they will consult closely, and we can bring them back into management incrementally. Al-Qaeda had changed a great deal in the 7 or 8 years since their imprisonment. A new generation was moving into junior and middle management. Increasingly, even bin Laden had to ask Mahmud for background on people who were unfamiliar to him. Meanwhile, al-Qaeda itself had morphed from a close-knit, intensely hierarchical battalion into something more like an umbrella organization, with a central staff overseeing a number of more or less autonomous franchises across the Muslim world. Any returnees would need time to come to grips with this new power structure. Around October of 2010, one of the former grandees was released, the enigmatic military chieftain Saif al-Adal. In Saif's case, Mahmud's recommendation of a 6-month reintegration program proved prescient. Just over half a year after his release, Saif was to be called up as interim emir upon bin Laden's death. Like their sheikh, Mahmud and his men lived continually on the brink. Alongside the rigors of a life in hiding, they had to contend with checkpoints, curfews, attacks by the Pakistani military, infiltration by spies, and above all, the relentless attrition of missile strikes. The harm is alarming, wrote a senior jihadi in 2009. The matter is very grave. So many brave commanders have been snatched away. So many safe houses have been leveled. Names of the men Mahmud called martyrs peppered his correspondence. Khalid al-Habib, the man who replaced KSM as al-Qaeda's operations director, Abu Laith al-Libi, a senior commander, and like Mahmud, a Libyan. Even Saeed al-Masri, who by the time of his death was functionally third in command, the man who accepted pledges of allegiance from new members on behalf of bin Laden and Zawahiri. On August 22, 2011, within half a year of bin Laden's death, Mahmud himself would be killed in a drone strike. It was the same day anti-Gaddafi forces captured Tripoli, the capital of his native Libya. Through Mahmud, bin Laden wielded executive control over a network of extremist groups from Afghanistan to Algeria. Mahmud kept in regular contact with the leadership of franchises like Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and Al-Shabaab in the Horn of Africa. Not only did bin Laden continue to command these groups, he frequently micromanaged their operations, inserting himself into decisions on everything from hostage negotiations, if they are spies, shoot them, otherwise negotiate for withdrawal from Afghanistan, whether or not you demand a cash ransom in addition, to which crops were best suited to the Somali climate, dates, olives, fruit trees, to the storage and rationing of wheat. The key, he told Mahmud, was to buy waterproof barrels. You should wash them and dry them in the sun for a day. These barrels have a rubber top to make them airtight and make it possible to store fresh grain for 7 years without allowing bugs to get to it. When it came to the core group in Waziristan, the Sheikh frequently involved himself in detailed personnel matters. Please send me the resumes of all the brothers who might be nominated for high administrative positions now or in the future, he ordered Mahmud in 2010. At the same time, he advised Mahmud to appoint a deputy for himself on a 1-year renewable term, and a second deputy just in case. He suggested jobs for some members, mentoring for others, and advised on matters of payroll. It would be a bad idea, he said, to pay the brothers their salaries in advance, because they would be liable to spend all the money and then come back and ask for a loan, which would put their superiors in an awkward position. Security remained a perennial preoccupation, and bin Laden's instructions to Mahmud on the subject tended to be as detailed as they were peremptory. Keep all movements to a minimum. If you must travel, do so only on cloudy days to avoid detection from above. Meet in groups of no more than 3 at a time. Carry out background checks on members with security-sensitive roles, especially the couriers. Whenever you receive ransom money, launder it twice. Exchange it for euros at one bank, then take those euros to another bank and exchange them for U.S. dollars. Family members who traveled with Al-Qaeda members should learn the local language in order to blend in. Children should be kept indoors unless they need to go out for essential medical treatment. And when they play in the yard, there must be a grown-up present to keep them quiet. Finally, in the matter of appointments, the organization must be as hard-nosed as any business. Members who were not disciplined enough to keep strictly to the security protocol should be relieved of command responsibility. Perhaps a job in the field might be best for them, the Sheikh said. The clunky courier system seemed preposterous to Mahmud. How can we correspond with brothers in Algeria, Iraq, Yemen, and Somalia? He asked, pressing for the use of email. No, bin Laden told him. Couriers are the only way. Security procedures in our circumstances should be practiced at all times, he wrote. There is no room for mistakes. Martyrdom was better than arrest, he had always said. But the ideal was to stay both alive and at liberty. Bin Laden knew what it meant to be hunted by the United States when the Obama administration added Anwar al-Awlaki, the Yemeni-American cleric and leading Al-Qaeda propagandist, to its list of specially designated global terrorists. Bin Laden sent instructions through Mahmud that Awlaki must now change his lifestyle completely, for the enemies of Allah will be after him. Awlaki would need instructions for his movements and directions about whom he is to see and how, and whom he is to avoid. After years of being hunted, Bin Laden had developed a sixth sense for possible security breaches. When the Afghan government agreed to pay $6 million to release one of its diplomats from Al-Qaeda custody, he smelled a rat. The Afghans did not usually hand over that much cash to spring their operatives. The hostage must be the relative of someone important, Bin Laden speculated. Moreover, he suspected American involvement. Perhaps they were tracking the money in the expectation that it might lead them to its ultimate recipient among the field commanders in Waziristan. Either way, the cash should be laundered even more carefully than usual. More than 4 years later, an article in the New York Times seemed to confirm Bin Laden's instincts. According to the report, the diplomat was the son-in-law of a mentor to the Afghan president, Hamid Karzai. Part of the ransom had indeed come from American coffers, although there was apparently no program of surveillance attached. For Bin Laden and the Waziristan contingent alike, secrecy was paramount. But it is axiomatic that no terrorist organization can afford to operate completely in the shadows. They always require the oxygen of publicity. Skillful image management through the media is a must. Bin Laden therefore paid close attention to all the output of Al-Sahab, the cloud, Al-Qaeda's press shop. This was the domain of Adam Gadan, a Californian farm boy and former death metal enthusiast who in 2006 earned the dubious distinction of being the first American to be charged with treason since World War II. Until the advent of the Islamic State, Gadan's cloud was the gold standard in jihadi propaganda, producing exciting videos with high production values, and the outfit could boast of a strong track record of reaching mainstream news reports. In the absence of any new spectacular attacks on the West, however, Al-Qaeda was finding it harder and harder to secure coverage. When Ayman al-Zawahiri released a video marking the 9th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, Bin Laden complained that Al Jazeera had shown it only in the middle of the night and had removed it from their rolling news coverage after just a few hours. In his frustration, Bin Laden suggested sending a complaint to Ahmed Zeidan, the network's Islamabad bureau chief. When it came to the rapidly approaching 10th anniversary, Al-Qaeda would have to do better. Bin Laden's vision for commemorating this milestone was nothing if not grandiose. The Sheikh instructed his underlings to negotiate with Arab and Western media outlets for glossy packages to commemorate the occasion, mentioning by name Al Jazeera, the British-headquartered newspapers The Independent and Al-Quds Al-Arabi, and the CBS television network, which he praised as an American channel that is close to neutrality and professionalism. In the case of Al Jazeera, Bin Laden's demands were particularly clear. He wanted a special program, and he wanted Ahmed Zeidan to present it. 1 year for finishing it is not enough, he told Mahmud, adding that Zeidan needs to create a vision for the program and review it several times. He will also need to interview a large number of people in various areas in the world. But Bin Laden stipulated, ask him not to interview anyone in my family. Negotiations on this issue should continue until an agreement that will satisfy Al-Sahab is reached. Please keep me posted. Nor was the Sheikh content simply to dwell on past glories. On the contrary, he had his sights set on the future. His keen interest in the appointment of deputies for Mahmud shows his concern for continuity, as does his insistence that his own number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri, be copied on all important correspondence. As always, Bin Laden was thinking big. In early 2010, he gave orders to set up a new Al-Qaeda research and development center, to be staffed by members with a passion for reading, who could focus on finding and translating Western research teaching English to their colleagues, and developing specialties like political science, computer engineering, and chemistry, especially the making of explosives. Adam Gadan should be involved, together with other members familiar with the ways of the West. Above all, the overlord of 9/11 was focused on preparing to strike the U.S. homeland once again. He remained characteristically clear-eyed about the rationale for this. "It is a known fact," he wrote, "that the American people, who are represented by the Congress and the White House, are the holders of the supreme power in the U.S., and they are the ultimate decision-makers. Thus, we have to focus on killing and fighting the American people." One spectacular attack inside the United States, he reasoned, would have more impact on American foreign policy than any conceivable combination of coalition deaths in Iraq or Afghanistan. And he had the statistics to back up his argument. The Vietnam War, he said, took the lives of 57,000 American troops before the U.S. public forced a withdrawal. Smoking killed 400,000 Americans a year without drawing many high-profile protests against the tobacco companies. Contrast that with the country's reaction to the so-called underwear bomber, Omar Farouk Abdulmutallab, a Nigerian who had attempted to blow up a Northwest Airlines flight to Detroit on Christmas Day 2009. With a single device on board a civilian plane, Farouk had played havoc with the U.S. transportation system and the American economy, and his bomb had not even exploded. Attacking the United States from within is of extreme importance, bin Laden told one of his senior lieutenants. Again, he turned to Mahmoud, asking him to nominate a qualified brother to be in charge of a large operation in America. Selecting the right candidate for this duty was essential, and bin Laden was prepared to be choosy. Indeed, he rejected two of Mahmoud's initial suggestions as unsuitable. He ordered the militants to create a training camp to prepare leaders for operations inside the United States. Again, the group should be very careful in choosing the initial cohort for this Academy of Terror. The students should be pious and patient, apply proficiency at all times, and have a strong conviction about the importance of external work. They must also possess intelligence, astuteness, knowledge, and enough stamina to see the training through. Later, the New Yorker was to report that at the time of his death, bin Laden was overseeing the development of plots to assassinate President Obama, to attack trains, and to strike on the 10th anniversary of 9/11. In bin Laden's mind, there was a strong strategic rationale for going after the United States first, before turning to battle ungodly regimes nearer at hand in the Islamic world. Bin Laden took frequent pains to stress this reasoning. As he explained to Mahmoud in a 2009 letter, "By fighting the local enemy, we don't get the result that we deployed for, which is to reinstate the wise caliphate and eliminate the disgrace and humiliation that our nation is suffering from. We should keep in mind that America still has the power to lay siege to any Islamic state, and that such a siege might force the people to overthrow their duly elected governments. We have to continue with exhausting and depleting the United States until they become so weak that they can't overthrow any state that we establish. That will be the time to commence forming the Islamic State." By concentrating his ire on America, bin Laden had staked out a stark position in a doctrinal dispute with deep theological roots. It starts with the Quran's prohibition against killing Muslims, which could scarcely be any clearer, nor the penalty for transgression any graver. "It is unlawful for a believer to kill another believer," reads the injunction. "He that kills a believer by design shall burn in hell forever." But this raises the question, what about those who profess outwardly to be Muslims, but who are not believers in their hearts? Within 3 decades of the Prophet's death, radicals among the Kharijites, Islam's first schismatics, had declared the fourth caliph, Ali ibn Abi Talib, to be a false Muslim. On this basis, in AD 661, Some of their number had assassinated Ali inside a mosque in Kufa, Iraq, using a sword tipped with poison. 600 years later, Muslims in what is now Iraq and Syria faced a problem when their land was conquered by Mongols, descendants of Genghis Khan, who had since converted to Sunni Islam. A Syrian cleric named Ibn Taymiyyah, a scholar who sought to defy Mongol rule, issued religious rulings to the effect that the Mongols were not true Muslims. As proof, he cited their heretical belief that their forebear, Genghis Khan, was the son of God, and worse, in Ibn Taymiyyah's mind, a prophet comparable in prestige to Muhammad himself. Moreover, the Mongol rulers had placed Genghis's man-made law, the Yasa, on par with the Islamic Sharia, and had employed Jews and Christians in high offices of state. In short, the whole Mongol political superstructure was rotten and un-Islamic. Thus, it was not only legal to fight and kill the Mongol overlords. Believers were commanded to do so. Ibn Taymiyyah's fatwas were documents anchored firmly in their time and place, promulgated to solve a problem particular to Muslims living in Iraq and the Levant in the late 13th and early 14th centuries. But that did not stop the 20th century Egyptian radical Sayyid Qutb from seizing upon them to justify his own call to overthrow the secular regime of Gamal Abdel Nasser. In turn, Qutb influenced succeeding generations of jihadis, particularly in North Africa, to take up arms against their own governments. These radicals are known as Takfiris, those who believe that the principal problem facing modern-day Muslims is their rulers' departure from the true path of Islam. The word takfir refers to a judgment that someone is an unbeliever, kafir, or an apostate, murted, literally backslider. For obvious reasons, in mainstream Islam and even in many relatively radical interpretations, it is extremely difficult to make such a declaration. Takfiris, on the other hand, apply the judgment of takfir with a much broader brush. They prescribe a certain way of practicing Islam and brand as deserving of death any Muslim who fails to live up to it. This is helter-skelter logic. Make your version of Islam restrictive enough, and there is no limit to how many people you can give yourself permission to murder. Thus today, in the very same region where Ibn Taymiyyah wrote his fatwas 7 centuries ago, we see a Takfiri group that calls itself the Islamic State demanding allegiance to its so-called caliph on pain of death by decapitation. Bin Laden would have agreed that the stain of apostasy needed to be erased. Certainly, there would come a time for visiting harsh judgment on kafir and murtadin. But, as he had always maintained, it was simply a waste of time to attack local secular regimes until their puppet masters in Washington were out of the picture. Takfiri groups tended to dislike Al-Qaeda because it had a habit of siphoning off recruits and reprogramming them to focus on the jihad against the far enemy, the United States, rather than the local quarrels the Takfiris wanted to pursue. But the 9/11 attacks would prove to be the high watermark for bin Laden's view of global jihad. After 9/11, with local conflicts on the rise across the Middle East and North Africa, he faced increasing difficulty keeping a lid on the Takfiri tendency within Al-Qaeda, especially following the rise to prominence of the most notorious Takfiri in recent memory, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Now in 2009 and 2010, it fell to Mahmoud to remind Al-Qaeda's membership of the central importance of defeating America first. For example, through Mahmoud, bin Laden instructed Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb to negotiate ceasefires with local forces because we want the maximum number of entities to take to the sidelines as we fight our greatest enemy, the U.S. Likewise in Yemen, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula should bear in mind that the enemy was the Americans, not the regime, even as they suffered daily attacks by Yemeni security forces. In 2010, in the midst of Yemen's civil war, bin Laden rejected his Yemeni associates' advice that the capital, Sana'a, was al-Qaeda's for the taking. Instead, he suggested that al-Qaeda try to reach a truce with the apostate government of Ali Abdullah Saleh in order to focus on fighting the United States. Bin Laden further ordered that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula must not escalate matters in Saudi Arabia for the same reason. Even in Pakistan, Bin Laden wrote, al-Qaeda should try to reach a truce with the local military. Bin Laden held fast to his view that there was no point in seeking to topple apostate regimes in the Muslim world, however evil they may be, and however far they had strayed from God's plan, until you had destroyed the ability of the West to protect them. But at the end of 2010, events were brewing that would bring about a sea change in Bin Laden's worldview. The Sheikh had always been an eager consumer of the news. One of the few enduring essentials of his otherwise drab lifestyle was the satellite dish on the property and a monitor to pick up Al Jazeera and the BBC. In this way, while in hiding, he kept on top of and was able to comment upon developments like the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, a Turkish-backed attempt to defy Israel's naval embargo on the Gaza Strip, the floods that devastated Pakistan in 2010, in which typically he saw yet another propaganda opportunity, and the release by WikiLeaks of 92,000 classified documents relating to the war in Afghanistan. In August 2010, he instructed Mahmoud to assign to some capable members the Herculean task of translating this potentially invaluable trove. But WikiLeaks was far from finished. 3 months later, they released another tranche of documents, this time sensitive cables from 274 U.S. diplomatic missions around the world. Many of them described in lurid detail the corruption and greed of Arab governments. A cable from the U.S. ambassador to Tunisia reported, "Whether it's cash, services, land, property, or yes, even your yacht, the Bin Ali family is rumored to covet it, and reportedly gets what it wants." Another cable detailed how Muammar Gaddafi's son, Mu'tasim, who served as Libya's national security advisor, paid the singer Beyoncé a substantial sum of money, perhaps as much as $1 million, to appear at his New Year's Eve party. Before he was toppled, the Libyan dictator assailed WikiLeaks as part of a foreign plot to destabilize Arab regimes. In reality, these revelations merely added to the already familiar examples of corruption, greed, and un-Islamic behavior available to opponents of these rotten governments. By the fall of 2010, simmering anger was ready to boil over all across the Arab world. On December 17th, a Tunisian street vendor named Mohamed Bouazizi set himself on fire to protest the deep-set corruption of the Zayn al-Abidine Ben Ali regime. By so doing, this otherwise unremarkable young man lit the fuse on popular protests that would spread throughout North Africa and beyond. Within a month, Tunisia's president had fled into exile in Bin Laden's own native Saudi Arabia. Demonstrators in Egypt took to chanting, "Ben Ali, tell Mubarak there is a plane waiting for him too." And sure enough, in the middle of February, the despised Pharaoh, whose regime and its predecessors had spilled the blood of many Egyptian jihadists, had announced his own resignation. By then, protests had erupted in Yemen, Sudan, Bahrain, Libya, Morocco, Iraq, Jordan, and beyond. There was even talk of an uprising in the land of the two holy mosques itself, although, in the event, it was swiftly suppressed by Saudi security, who also played a role in putting down the revolt in the neighboring island nation of Bahrain. Finally, on March 18th, Syria began its long descent into barbarism when President Bashar al-Assad's security forces opened fire on activists in Daraa, near the border with Jordan. Watching this dizzying scene unfold from his Abbottabad redoubt, Bin Laden sat transfixed. In correspondence with Mahmoud, and in successive drafts of a jumbled, rambling statement to the Ummah, the Islamic nation, the Sheikh's thoughts poured forth in a jubilant gush. "This is the most important point in our history," he breathlessly told Mahmud, drawing parallels with the time of Saladin, the 12th century sultan who retook Jerusalem after 88 years of crusader rule. Today's Arab dictators, to bin Laden's mind, embodied an even earlier figure, Abu Jahl, a powerful early opponent of the Prophet, backward, oblivious to the people's needs, soon to be hurled into the abyss by the forces of righteousness. There was a divine symmetry to be discerned in contemporary events. Whereas the 20th century had belonged to the Americans, the 21st had begun with the blessed attacks that pierced their strongholds of New York and Washington. And now, the second decade of this still young century was set to open with the fall of the puppet regimes propped up by the far enemy. Clearly, this was a sign. America had had its day. This was the start of the Muslim century. What was the end game of these revolutions? The dominant view in the West at the time was that the Arab Spring could be an opening for democracy and free speech in the Middle East, a development that would have killed extremist organizations like Al-Qaeda stone dead. But that was not how Osama bin Laden saw it. Characteristically, he viewed the Arab Spring as an opportunity to impose his own fundamentalist brand of religion using a form of government drawn from the earliest days of the Islamic Empire. "These gigantic events," he told Mahmud, "will eventually engulf most of the Muslim world. We'll free the Muslim land from American hegemony. We hope the next stage will be the reinstating of the rule of the caliphate." In the face of this tectonic upheaval, the role of Al-Qaeda itself would have to change. Already, Mahmud was saying goodbye to militants from North Africa and the Middle East. The chaos of revolution was an opportunity to see their homes and loved ones again after so many years, and it was also a chance to wage jihad in their countries of origin against regimes they had long despised. The departing fighters included yet another Libyan, Abu Anas al-Libi, a conspirator in the 1998 East African embassy bombings, who would be arrested in Tripoli in a daring joint FBI Delta Force operation in 2013. For bin Laden, this dispersal was all to the good. "Though the Mujahideen have several duties to perform," bin Laden wrote to Mahmud following the collapse of the Tunisian regime, "their main duty now is to support the revolutions taking place. This historic task," bin Laden said, "should take precedence even over the sacred struggle against the Americans in Afghanistan." "We must really mobilize," said the Sheikh. What exactly to do and how precisely to accomplish it were much tougher questions. Al-Qaeda could not support the uprisings too openly because the regimes would exploit that association to paint the demonstrators as extremists. Bin Laden took his father's birthplace of Yemen as an example. If Al-Qaeda openly joined the demonstrations, he wrote, the government would tell the people that the demonstrators are Al-Qaeda, and that will hurt the people's cause in Yemen. Moreover, he went on, if we select a date to call for civil disobedience and demonstrations, then the activists will think that we want to pick the fruits of their labor without them. So let them pick the fruit. Similarly, it would not pay to be too honest about Al-Qaeda's ultimate objective. We should talk about toppling the tyrants without talking about issues related to the caliphate, bin Laden told Mahmud. Still, the revolutions needed to be kept on track somehow. Otherwise, today's movements are in danger of falling into the trap of creating a system that is different from what God has ordered us to implement. In other words, free speech and democracy. Moreover, for all his exuberance, the Sheikh remained haunted by the failure of past uprisings in Algeria, Egypt, Yemen, and elsewhere. The key, he wanted to advise those involved in the rebellions, was to be resolute and uncompromising. Bin Laden's ideas on the subject were clear. Do not present a prominent figurehead, because he can too easily be killed or co-opted. Do not be squeamish about bloodletting, because it is an inevitable part of the liberation struggle. Do not cast the security forces as the first enemy of the people, because they can be turned onto the path of God. Above all, Do not be tempted to compromise with the ruler, even if it means less bloodshed in the short term. Only if you strip away every last vestige of power can you be sure that the dictator will not simply turn around later and reimpose the tyranny that brought you to the streets in the first place. This root-and-branch approach, bin Laden observed, was one reason for the success of the Ayatollahs in Iran, a rare compliment to a Shiite regime he otherwise consistently viewed as evil and rejectionist. An important part of al-Qaeda's long-term strategy, memorialized in works like the infamous Jihadi Handbook, The Management of Savagery, had always been to recreate so-called zones of savagery, regions within the Muslim world so lawless and chaotic that the authority of the state would collapse. Al-Qaeda could then rush in to fill the vacuum left by governmental failure, providing the people with much-needed services like education, water, and electricity, and ruling in accordance with its version of Islam. For bin Laden, Zawahiri, and the rest of the Al-Qaeda old guard, this was meant to be a slow and deliberate methodology, lasting perhaps as long as several generations. But the rapid collapse of regimes during the Arab Spring represented an opportunity to short-circuit the management of savagery process. Once again, bin Laden took Yemen as his principal example. The fragmentation in the region after the fall of the regime, he wrote, will make the area ripe for a positive response. Reform in this environment will be strong, and America and Saudi Arabia will have little influence in the matter. As prophetic as his words might prove, a man like Osama bin Laden, who had sought to sway world events for a quarter century, could never be satisfied with simply offering advice, prognostications, and encouragement from the sidelines, while others made history. And yet, even with Al Jazeera's rolling coverage as a constant companion, it was hard enough just to keep up with the frantic pace of events, let alone seek to affect the outcome in any meaningful way. Clearly, these historic times would require a more considered response from Al-Qaeda, and it was clear who should lead the blue sky thinking: the omni-capable Mahmud. Around the beginning of March, bin Laden told his assistant that his work in Waziristan had come to an end. "You should work as soon as possible on arranging a safe route for getting to the Peshawar area until we find you a house in the area that I am in. This will allow you to monitor the media better and will facilitate correspondence between us to exchange opinions." At the same time, bin Laden set about creating a brain trust, Mahmud's deputy and countryman Abu Yahya al-Libi should also leave Waziristan for a safer locale, as should the rest of the brothers with strong capabilities. Do not exclude any one of them, for each voice counts at this phase. The work is going to be a joint effort. Bin Laden even indicated that he was open to a face-to-face meeting with Mahmud. This would break the 8-year isolation he had imposed on himself following the arrest of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. But such was the importance of the hour. "My words contradict what I said in previous letters," he wrote, "but the magnitude of the events dictates that we implement a full mobilization." For all the weight of historic responsibility he felt, a sense of his own importance with which Al-Qaeda's membership, almost a decade after 9/11, still heartily agreed, bin Laden was also still the patriarch of a large and still growing family. Since the early 1980s, he had wed a total of 5 women and was still married to 3 of them when he entered the Abbottabad house in 2005. Between his 5 wives, bin Laden fathered a minimum of 20 children, including at least 4 born while he was in hiding. According to ancient Arab custom, each wife was accorded a kunya, or nickname, honoring her for the birth of her first son, Abdullah, the mother of Abdullah, Ali, the mother of Ali, and so on. By the end of 2010, 2 of bin Laden's 3 remaining wives, Siham Sabar, known as Khalid, and Amal al-Sada, known as Ibrahim, were living with him in Abbottabad. Amal had married bin Laden in the late 1990s, when she was only 16 years old. The wives took turns spending the night with their husband in his third-floor quarters. Downstairs on the second floor lived Osama's son by Siham, Khalid bin Laden. Khalid, around 22 years old in 2010, shared his father's distinctive slender nose and full lips. He served as the compound's resident handyman and plumber. He also kept a cow he had bought from a local farmer, and like all of the men of the Abbottabad mansion, he knew his way around a Kalashnikov and was prepared, if need be, to defend the Sheikh with deadly force. By 2007, Khalid had reached his late teens. It was high time for him to marry. His mother, Khalid, had proposed a match with a girl whose father and brother had both died for the cause. Indeed, her father was an Egyptian militant whose fame in the jihad went back to the early 1980s. During the war against the Soviets, he was rumored to have killed more communist soldiers than any other Arab. His proficiency with the BM-12 rocket launcher earned him the nickname Abu Abdul Rahman BM. By marrying this revered man's daughter, in other words, Khalid would make a match fit for the son of Osama bin Laden. The girl's mother, Abdul Rahman, was agreeable, but the family did not live nearby, and the need for security made a meeting between the bride and groom extremely difficult, especially in light of her mother's insistence that the girl and her husband stay near them for at least 4 years following the wedding. Time passed by with no resolution, and by November of 2010, with Khalid now in his early 20s, his mother was beginning to worry that losing too much time waiting may result in missing the train for both of them. She suggested a deadline of 4 months, after which time, if it was still impossible to arrange the wedding, they would call it off. But by April 2011, Khalid judged that matters had improved enough that the bride and groom could safely meet. All of a sudden, the wedding was back on, and the four-month deadline was forgotten. "I hope you will consider it completely canceled," Khalid wrote to Abdul Rahman. Khalid began making arrangements to travel to the home of his new fiancée, and Khalid, the proud mother of the groom, looked forward to the day when their two families would be joined. "We have been through difficult security circumstances," she wrote to the woman who would soon be her son's mother-in-law. "However, by the grace of Allah, things changed, and every day that goes by our situation goes from good to better. Bin Laden valued all his wives. In his interpretation of scripture, Muslim men were permitted to marry up to 4 women at a time. The Quran instructs believers to maintain equality among their wives. What advocates of polygamy often forget, however, is that a few verses later the Quran also warns, 'Try as you may, you cannot treat all your wives impartially.' Bin Laden had fallen into this trap. It was widely known that his favorite of all his wives had long been Khairiyya Sabar, the mother of Hamza. 7 years bin Laden's senior, Hamza, came from a respected family in Jeddah, his Saudi hometown. She had a PhD in child psychology, and prior to the bin Laden family's flight to Afghanistan in the mid-1990s, had held an appointment as a university professor. During the family's stay in Khartoum, Sudan, she had educated women on Islamic theology, and among bin Laden's inner circle, she was regarded as a wise confidant, with the ability to keep people's spirits up, even in desperate times. But for most of the past decade, bin Laden and his most beloved wife had suffered a forced exile from each other. In the chaos that followed the American-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, while bin Laden hid in Pakistan, Hamza had fled along with a number of other al-Qaeda supporters and their families westward, through Iran, intending eventually to travel to Syria. But she and her companions had been arrested by Iranian forces and imprisoned there for 9 excruciating years. Finally, in the late summer of 2010, the day before the start of the holy month of Ramadan, Hamza's bonds were broken. In the weeks that followed, she made her way to Waziristan to meet with Mahmud and the militants under his command. Bin Laden was overjoyed. He instructed Mahmud to ensure that Hamza was kept safe and comfortable and authorized use of his personal funds for the purpose. But the sheikh's ultimate plan was for Hamza to join him in Abbottabad at the earliest possible opportunity. He missed his wife dearly. Her return, he told her, would fill our hearts with joy. But his desire for her presence was about much more than the natural tug of marital affection. With the 10th anniversary of 9/11 approaching, he wanted Hamza's sage and sensitive eye on every statement to be released to the world. Of all the members of bin Laden's inner circle, she was among the best educated and most sensitive. Moreover, she had been with him since before Al-Qaeda was even thought of. They had married in 1985 when he was still fighting the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. As well as holding her and their son Hamza in such high regard, bin Laden had long considered Hamza one of his closest advisors. She was one of the few people he truly trusted to help him finesse his message. He therefore instructed the Waziristan contingent to buy her a computer, peripherals, and flash drives so that she could compose her thoughts and send them to him. Meanwhile, Mahmud was to proceed with making arrangements for her safe passage east to Abbottabad. Naturally, moving Hamza across Pakistan would be a delicate matter. A wife of bin Laden, particularly one who had been held in Tehran and interrogated by Iranian intelligence, would be a glittering prize for the Pakistani authorities, not to mention the Americans, especially if her movements led them to the man himself. If it was to happen at all, Hamza's journey would require careful choreography, and this would take time. To start with, she would need to learn enough Urdu so as not to raise suspicions along the way. To guard against the implantation of microscopic monitoring devices, she must not bring any of the possessions the Iranian authorities had allowed her to keep while in custody. Anything a needle might puncture could conceivably be bugged, including even the filling an Iranian official dentist had put into her tooth. If the filling was done less than a year ago, bin Laden warned, the bug might still be live, and Hamza should go to a doctor in Waziristan, say that the tooth was causing her pain, and have it removed. After all, the Iranians are not to be trusted. Nor was the possibility of detection the only difficulty to deal with. With around 24 people already under their protection, Al-Kuwaiti and Abrar were becoming overwhelmed with their task, and grumbled that they were extremely reluctant to accept any more bin Laden family members. With so many hurdles to overcome, Hamza's return may have seemed practically impossible, but bin Laden's need for her was so powerful and immediate that by wintertime he was even becoming desperate enough to toy with the idea of trekking across the country himself to be near her. An almost suicidally reckless mission for the world's most wanted man. One can only imagine Mahmud's reaction to that suggestion. Indeed, this proposal may have been a ploy to galvanize the membership into action. Soon afterward, they were finally able to find a way to send Hamza to bin Laden. She arrived at the Abbottabad compound on February 12, 2011. It was the day after the fall of Mubarak, and bin Laden must have been doubly pleased to have his wordsmith with him now that the Arab revolutions were in full swing, and he was in the throes of formulating his defining message to the Ummah. Like her husband, Hamza had never been in the best of health. As a result of her frailty, while she and bin Laden were trying to conceive, she endured a number of miscarriages. But as her kunya indicates, she did bear him one son. Hamza bin Laden was born in the late 1980s, around the same time as his half-brother Khalid. The last known pictures of Hamza come from jihadist propaganda videos of the late 1990s, where he can be seen as a prepubescent boy, looking like a miniature version of his father, undergoing assault training, hanging out with the Mujahideen, and preaching fiery sermons in a helium voice. After 9/11, he was taken prisoner in Iran alongside his mother. Captivity did nothing to dim Hamza's youthful militancy. His only frustration, he told his father in a letter smuggled out to Abbottabad, was that, because he had grown up largely in Iranian custody, the Mujahideen legions have marched and I have not joined them. After his marriage, while in detention, to a daughter of the longtime al-Qaeda commander Abu Muhammad al-Masri, Hamza even named his firstborn son Osama and his daughter Khairiya to honor his father and mother. As he told bin Laden, God created them to serve you. Hamza was released from prison in Iran on the same day as his mother, August 10, 2010. Like her, he made his way to Waziristan to join with Mahmud and the other militants based there. Bin Laden briefly explored the idea of trying to persuade the Iranians to send his son elsewhere in the Gulf region, or having Mahmud's men send him there themselves. But this proved impossible, partly because Hamza would be too tempting a target for the Americans. Besides, if God permitted, the Sheikh wanted his son by his side. Again, there were more than family ties in play. As a boy, Hamza had showed himself a precocious jihadi. Growing into a man in Iranian captivity, he studied scripture and became learned in Sharia or Islamic law. Now in Waziristan, he was eager for the al-Qaeda fighters to train him in the ways of war. Mahmud was full of praise for his young protege. "He is very sweet and good," he told bin Laden. "I see in him wisdom and politeness. He does not want to be treated with favoritism because he is the son of someone." If there was a bin Laden boy suited to carrying on his father's legacy, Hamza was his best hope. But bin Laden had been down this road before. A few years previously, the Sheikh had tried bestowing executive responsibility on another of his sons, an elder half-brother of Hamza named Saad. Saad, too, had been imprisoned in Iran, but by the middle of August 2008 he had been set free, or had escaped. Like Hamza, 2 years later, Saad made his way to Waziristan, but Saad behaved recklessly, and sometime in the first half of 2009 he was killed by an American missile. Saad died, peace be upon him, because he was impatient, Mahmud told bin Laden in a letter. The Sheikh tried to keep his son's death quiet, but word got out. Bin Laden demanded to know how the news had leaked and instructed his underlings to destroy photos taken of Saad after his death. His concern was not just that of a grieving father, but that of a leader with his eye on the future. "We pray that God reward us for his loss and grant us a successor," he wrote to Hamza. Bin Laden was not going to allow Hamza to meet the same fate as his half-brother. The operatives in Waziristan had orders to keep Hamza indoors, in conditions Mahmud likened to a prison. Bin Laden even insisted on personally vetting the man assigned to guard his son. These strictures irked Hamza, who had so recently been released from captivity. But needs must. Hamza was not to leave the house unless absolutely necessary. By early April of 2011, Mahmud was close to hatching a plan for Hamza to join his father in Abbottabad. Hamza would travel directly north, over mountains ruled by the Khyber tribes, or else he would go south, through the badlands of Baluchistan. This latter route was not the most direct, but it was the safest, and for that reason the one Mahmud recommended. Indeed, with this option, Hamza's wife and children could even journey with him. Once in Baluchistan, they would rendezvous with Umar Siddiq Katio Azmari, a.k.a. Abdullah al-Sindi, one of al-Qaeda's most seasoned and trusted fixers. Al-Sindi knew Pakistan like the back of his hand and had already worked for members of the bin Laden family, including Hamza's late half-brother Saad, for many years. To get him through the checkpoints along the road, Hamza even had a fake ID courtesy of his other half-brother, Khalid. By late April of 2011, Hamza waited in Waziristan, praying only for a cloudy sky to speed him on his way. Osama bin Laden had always made much of dreams and visions, those of others as well as his own. He enjoyed discussing them and divining what they might mean. To him, this was no idle parlor game. Correctly interpreted, the Sheikh believed, dreams could function as windows on the future. In the mid-1990s, he believed that he had foretold in his sleep the accession of Prince Abdullah to the throne of Saudi Arabia, an event that would not actually come to pass for another decade. Immediately before 9/11, his followers had recounted prophetic dreams of planes striking buildings and Al-Qaeda pilots beating the United States at soccer. In Abbottabad, the Sheikh was still dreaming, and in the second half of 2010, the portents appeared auspicious. "Good news," he wrote to his mother on August 26th. In the middle of Ramadan, in a dream, he told her, "I saw that I had been chased by a huge black snake. Next thing, I was grabbing its head. I opened its mouth, and I saw that all the teeth had shattered. Praise God! There were brothers close by. I told them, 'There is no harm,' or 'It won't hurt you,' because we smashed its teeth. Praise God!" Indeed, a few months later, in the middle of spring 2011, things seemed to be looking up for Al-Qaeda and its leader. Slowly but surely, he was bringing his family back together. The Arab Spring was sweeping away hated tyrants with breathtaking speed, possibly paving the way for the restoration of the caliphate. Bin Laden and his deputies had even begun reaching out to heal a developing rift between Al-Qaeda and the splinter group that had taken to calling itself the Islamic State of Iraq, ISI. Not all was well, however. The Sheikh's security arrangements, though they had served him well for almost a decade, were far from foolproof. Much later, when they were asked to explain why bin Laden had so little visible security around him in Abbottabad, his wives would say that the Sheikh trusted in God for his protection. The reality, of course, was far more mundane. Conspicuous security would have attracted attention. As the Rhode Island Senator Jack Reed put it, "If you had 25 18-year-olds with guns, then not only would the CIA notice, but so would the Pakistani military." A low profile, therefore, was the only way to go. The downside of this was that the entire burden of protection and concealment fell upon Al-Kuwaiti and Abrar, the faithful Pashtun brothers, who blended in so well with the city around them. One false move from either of them could have grave consequences for the Sheikh, for his family, and for global jihad itself. By 2010, the cumulative stress of concealing and providing for the most wanted terrorist in history, not to mention his ever-expanding entourage of family members, was taking its toll on Al-Kuwaiti and his brother. As if to underline the point, their nerves had been tested to the breaking point by a recent scare. Watching television one night, Al-Kuwaiti's 9-year-old daughter had correctly identified bin Laden from a news report on Al Jazeera. In a blind panic, Al-Kuwaiti had banned his family from visiting the main house, interacting with the bin Ladens, or even watching television. Bin Laden himself was beginning to notice in his hosts the listlessness that managers of all kinds recognize among the classic symptoms of burnout. "They are getting exhausted, security-wise, from my staying with them," he wrote to Hamza. "In fact, they have reached a level of exhaustion where they are shutting down. I think that I have to leave them, but it will take a few months to arrange another place." Al-Kuwaiti reassured his wife that he would soon be relieved of his almost unbearable burden. Perhaps he would even be given some property in a safer locale where they could finally live out their lives in peace. Life in seclusion cannot have been easy for the Sheikh himself, an eager outdoorsman who had spent his youth, and a great deal of time since, defying his frequent bouts of ill health by playing soccer, climbing mountains, riding horses, and shooting guns. Still, he had reason to be thankful. "As far as I am concerned," he told Hamza, "God Almighty has been very generous to me." Khalid would soon be wed, and to the daughter of an esteemed martyr, no less. Hamza, the favored wife, was already with him, and Hamza, her golden son, was on his way, God willing. Mahmud would soon be nearby, and bin Laden looked forward to working with him to plan the next stage of jihad. His security situation remained delicate, of course, but as bin Laden had once told Mahmud, "The facts prove that the American technology and advanced systems cannot capture a mujahid. if he does not make a security violation that will lead them to him. In other words, you can only get caught if you make a mistake. Besides, by late April, the family felt their situation was improving. Hamza captured their mood in upbeat terms. "We consider this to be the beginning of a new era," she wrote, "especially since our security is getting better, and the signs for victory for our mujahideen have begun to be seen." Within a week, Osama bin Laden was dead. Amal awoke after midnight to the sound of what seemed like a tempest barreling through the valley. This was strange, for the monsoon was not due to hit Obanabad for another 2 months or more. In fact, early May was meant to be among the drier times of the year. Together with her husband, Osama, Amal crept out onto the balcony. The air was clear, with only a light breeze brushing at their faces. Not a drop of rain was falling. There was no lightning to crack the sky, nor even a moon to illuminate the valley. It was neither too warm nor too cold, a comfortable 66 degrees Fahrenheit. It was, in fact, yet another pleasant Abbottabad evening of the kind that had drawn the British here more than a century and a half ago. But something was wrong. The storm noise swirled around them, louder and louder, building to a crescendo. Back indoors, Amal reached for the light switch. "No," said Osama. Amal drew back her hand. Her youngest child, 3-year-old Hussein, was spending the night in the same room as Osama and his mother, while their other children slept elsewhere in the house. No doubt they, too, had heard the commotion outside and would be frightened. Amal padded downstairs to try to calm them. When she returned, two of Osama's older daughters, Mariam and Sumaya, both in their late teens or early 20s, had joined him in the master bedroom, along with some of Mariam's own children. "There is no God but God," they recited together, "and Muhammad is the messenger of God." Outside, the tempest's fury rose higher and higher, until the whole fabric of the building seemed to shake. The walls of the Abbottabad Valley formed a natural echo chamber, so that there was no way of knowing which direction the sound was coming from. But Osama had more than an inkling of what was happening and of the forces behind it. The family continued their recitation. "I bear witness that there is no God except Allah. He is one. He has no partner. And I bear witness that Muhammad is his servant and messenger." When they had finished reciting the confession of the faith, Osama turned to the women. "American helicopters have arrived," he told them. "All of you must leave this room at once." They refused. They would remain, and so would Osama. Mariam took her children onto the balcony, while Amal and Sumaya struck up positions near Osama. On a shelf within reach of Osama's slender hands lay the Russian AK-74 assault rifle that had been his constant companion since the aftermath of the Battle of Jaji in Afghanistan, almost a quarter century before. On that occasion, legend said, Osama had led a handful of mujahideen to victory against Soviet Special Forces 200 strong. The gun, with its distinctive snub-nosed barrel and curving rust-red magazine, had been awarded to him on the field of triumph. But tonight, it would remain on its shelf. Downstairs, Khalid had picked up his own weapon, a more conventional AK-47, and was patrolling from floor to floor, in and out of the family rooms, checking on the women and children of the house. "Stay away from the windows," he told them. Almost a decade since the 9/11 attacks, the helicopters had indeed arrived, as Osama had said. They had come in low and fast from the north, skimming the treetops. Now, somewhere in the dark beyond bin Laden's walled-off third-floor balcony, two heavily modified Sikorsky UH-60 Blackhawks were disgorging their passengers, a crack team of 24 U.S. Navy SEALs, each of them specially selected and trained for this, one of the most important missions in the five-decade history of the world's deadliest clandestine fighting force. Each stage of the raid had an assigned code word. For the climax, the encounter with Osama, the word was Geronimo. With all the precision and coordination of a seasoned surgical team, the Americans ran through their checklist, blasting through doors, methodically sweeping room after room, floor after floor, building after building, confronting and killing the compound's defenders, cuffing women and children, and holding them in a downstairs room. In the guest house, Al-Kuwaiti grabbed his rifle and sprayed blindly into the night in the direction of the soldiers' voices. From outside, the SEALs returned fire, and Al-Kuwaiti fell dead. A short time later, over at the main house, the soldiers shot his brother, Abrar, in the chest as he tried to fire at them with his rifle. Blood soaked his cream shalwar kameez. Abrar's wife, Bushra, was also killed, caught in the crossfire that felled her husband. From his position on the second floor of the main house, Khalid could hear the commotion downstairs. After the gunshots that killed Abrar and Bushra, their terrified children had begun wailing uncontrollably. Now soldiers were attaching C4 explosive charges to the metal door that guarded the stairwell. Khalid heard the blast, followed by an eerie calm. Then came another sound, not sharp this time, but uncanny. From out of the gloom, someone was whispering his name. Was it his father? One of the couriers? Unable to contain his curiosity, Khalid leaned out around a corner to see the source. A shot rang out, and Khalid fell dead, killed by the soldier who had breathed his name. The Americans stepped over Khalid's corpse with its spreading penumbra of blood and made their way toward the master bedroom on the top floor. Amal heard their footsteps on the stairs. Soon she perceived a swinging beam of red light, sharp against the all-engulfing blackness. An American soldier was drawing a bead on Osama. Amal screamed. She and Sumaya charged in the direction of the laser light. One of the SEALs turned, shot Amal in the leg, and shoved her and Sumaya to the floor. With a sudden pulse of pain, Amal passed out. That was when one of the Americans shot her husband in the head. "For God and country," the SEAL team commander radioed moments later. "Pass Geronimo, Geronimo, Geronimo." Not far from where Amal had collapsed lay the body of her husband, blood and tissue oozing from a V-shaped bullet hole above his eye socket. "Geronimo EKIA," the commander said. "Enemy killed in action." Nearby, Amal's son Hussein was weeping. Bin Laden had once told Mahmud that a mujahid could only be caught if he made a mistake. Did he wonder in his final moments how he had blundered? Perhaps he should have relieved his burned-out guards. Perhaps, after all, it had been a mistake to bring Hamza to his side, so soon after her Iranian ordeal. Did he think about the martyrs whose blessed company he would soon be keeping? He had reason to believe he would be well-received. Before he died, his own son, Saad, had pledged in his will to vouch for his father before God in heaven. Did Osama feel, in those last moments, a pang of regret that he had not managed to see Hamza one last time? Or was he simply glad that the favored son was not there to meet the same fate as Khalid and the other men? Finally, as deadly darkness descended over his eyes, did this brutal man feel any remorse for the thousands of innocent lives he and his followers had stolen in the name of a religion they had twisted into an ideology of blood? The compound's defenders, though faithful to the last, had been no match for the Americans. Apart from the exalted identity of the target and the risks of flying, stealthy and unbidden through Pakistani airspace, the mission was, at least for the highly specialized operatives who carried it out, routine. Later, American officials would liken the raid to mowing the lawn. It was as straightforward, they would say, as raiding a large house in suburban Virginia. That may have been true, but the consequences of that killing on a moonless mountain night would unspool on a global scale.